This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. I'm Grace Cavalieri. Our guest today is Rebecca Wee, a Witter-Binner Fellow at the Library of Congress. And here's Rebecca to say hello with an opening poem.
I will read the first poem in the book. Title is The Philosopher. A man rides a bicycle into town. He's forgotten his clothes, or maybe this is what he means to do. He rides carefully into the burning town. Apartments of old stone list, iron balconies, awnings, the window grates blacken with heat. He rides by. His lip perspires, his eyes intent. In the hills behind him there is a glow that is not the burning. The Acropolis, maybe, the dome of the rock. The man has a book under his arm. The pages are gilt-edged. The title has worn away. He has a shoulder wound also, an old crescent scar. Now his chest sweats, now his abdomen. He is more agile than laughter. The road turns. A black sedan rounds the corner behind him. They are leaving town, or they're trailing him. Either way, it's too late. The man is not cold without clothes. He sees whole worlds wherever he looks, and this keeps him busy. Maps and globes and civilizations not on fire. Now when he stops and considers the spokes, the bicycle tires, he sees ashes, nails, explosions of glass. He does not believe in this. He believes in something else.
Mm-hmm. The voice of Rebecca Wee. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress. Rebecca is the Witter-Binner Fellow, and she was appointed by Billy Collins. So what does that mean, and what will you do?
With the Witter-Binner Fellowship, the reading on April 15th was one part of the agreement, and the other is to give a reading in my community, which is the Quad Cities in Illinois.
So that you bring, you're sort of an ambassador to mm-hmm. your region.
Yes.
And so you'll promote and provide some sort of public affair.
Yes.
For poetry.
And it turns out that Witter-Binner himself concocted the Spectra hoax of, 1916 in that area, in the Quad Cities. So we're going to have some fun with that, I think.
Rebecca is reading from Uncertain Grace today, and this is her first book, and it was the winner of the second annual Hayden Carruth Award. I understand that there were more than 1,000 entries, Rebecca. Mm-hmm. Did you know that?
Yes, and the thing that I think that was most exciting for me was it was people who had, some of them, it's open to first and second books, so some of the people sending manuscripts had already published, so I felt...
Were you very happy? Were you very surprised?
Yes, I was stunned and quite pleased.
But you shouldn't have been surprised. This book in itself was nominated for other awards, the Lenore Marshall Award, and that was in 2002, and that's from the Academy of American Poets. Then it was nominated for the Midlands Author Award, mm-hmm. and then it won this great big national prize. So do you feel you're launched?
I don't know if you ever feel that. Yeah. I feel very fortunate, rather amazed, and I think the thing that's been best about it is that it legitimizes, I suppose, something that you've done so privately beforehand and makes you feel like, well, I better take this seriously if I wasn't before.
It has to give you energy to go on.
Yeah, it does.
That's the reason for it.
Yeah.
That's Rebecca Wee. And of this book, Carolyn Forché says, Uncertain Grace is a radiant and searing lyric pilgrimage through transformative love and unsparing loss. In place of platitudes of consolation and closure, we are given worlds closely beheld and the language of a soul finding its way. This is an exemplary first book. Let's have another poem.
All right. I will read For Billy, Hoopsnake, which is a poem he chose for his Poetry 180 collection. And I wrote this one for my husband, although we had only known each other very briefly. I think it was after our second encounter, and we had had a discussion about this creature, the hoopsnake. So it begins with a definition from the American Heritage Dictionary of the English Language about a hoop snake. Any of several snakes, such as the mud snake, said to grasp the tail in the mouth and move with a rolling hoop-like motion. Hoop snake. The second time we met, he told me about the hoop snake. Temporal, exquisite, a godless man, so I listened. We weren't sure, though, if it could be true. A snake that takes its tail in its mouth, then rolls through the world. But there are reasons to believe in God, and this seems a good one. We brought wine to the porch, spoke of piety, marriage, devotion assumed for reasons that could not sustain it. While lightning took apart the sky, the fields leapt up, the stream's muddy luster, its sinuous length, liminal, lush, the grass black, the unheard melodies and those that catch, the leaves beginning to fret. I don't remember now what he said, his eyes revising that dark. After he left, I walked through the grass, the rain, asked, how do things work? We are after something miraculous. We open our mouths, we believe, we turn. At times, we gather speed.
At the Library of Congress, The Poet and the Poem. I'm Grace Cavalieri, that's the voice of Rebecca. One thing about your work, and the immediate thing I felt when I read the book, was that you do something very interesting. You keep us at a distance. Do you feel that? And that allows us to get closer to you. You get next to your reader by writing from a great distance, and I was trying to analyze how you did that. But are you aware of that?
No, it's always very intriguing to hear how other people experience.
You're not in our face, you know, but you are in our souls when you finish the poem. And I think you do this many ways. One, actually, with a physical presentation on the page. Oftentimes, more often than not, it's the double space poem. So just physically, you create a lot of space. Often you use the smaller case letters.
Yeah, the white space is probably part of what you're talking about, that just visually there's a kind of openness, I suppose, to the poems.
But you also don't go very much into, you don't get in the middle of the landscape right away. You sometimes actually save it for the last line, and then you enter that little line of reality. Very interesting work and really beautiful and easy to take.
Well, thank you.
Another person speaks to this as well. Jane Miller, who actually judged this award, says these poems use natural speech and action to give them a sensual voice. Interestingly, the intimacies are in the minor notes, and yet these are emotional poems. That is so true. You are very delicate, very beneath the line. And then she adds, it draws our attention to reality and takes us on an arduous journey, after which my guess is readers will be thoughtful and for different reasons. So rich are the poems in their consequences. That's a great remark. And they are. They are consequential poems.
Thank you. Yeah, that pleased me too. Jane Miller had been a poet whose work I loved. Her book August Zero, when that came out, was one I carried around with me for a year. And so when I learned that she had been the one who picked it, you know, there's a special... oh, sort of glee, I suppose.
And you couldn't have known it, but you did have an epigraph by her in
adorning
one of the poems.
So
that is fate.
Yeah.
Let's have another.
All right. I will read After the Crazy Mountains. That is a mountain range, if I'm remembering this right, in Montana. And I wrote this poem. I like to drive cross-country, and I was heading west one summer, and a colleague of mine who teaches the literature of the West had said, any chance you can write a poem about the West? And usually, you know, you can't do that when you're asked for such a thing. But I was taking notes, and this poem came out of that. It has, it's a kind of catalog of run-on observations. There's not much punctuation, so it moves fairly quickly. There are journal notes. There are quotations from road signs. There are names of towns. And I realized I was following the Lewis and Clark Trail unintentionally, but I got pretty interested in doing that as a single woman in the 1990s in a Honda versus their experience covering the same land when they did. So this is after the Crazy Mountains. Marigolds in the breakfast eggs, a bottle of green light, a sill, the road sighs, spits, gravel flashing with glass, heat lightning, Apache tears, his voice lurching through phone lines, over borders, 90 degrees in a room in Butte, the carpet audibly green, an 80-ton steel Madonna on the Continental Divide, Marlboro in the towels, the sheets, on a wall, anaconda meat, signs for Tongue River, browse, silt, and no name. A woman traveling across the plains with a wagon train of emigrants went insane. Exhaust exhalations dropped like gauze from a plane. The migrant workers, bright shirts, bent flowers, they stoop through it, their backs, dusted fruit, trucks of beets. At dusk, a man crosses a street, fingers on the clumped throats of poppies, stems, their roots sweep the asphalt. The country is stitched with fence line. Quiet reminders, a crow's eye, the fleck of light it carries. Words in a book, worn with touch, with desire, the lick and shock of his voice. Every town again, again. Note. Learn to notice what you notice. The heated wood of a bench, this syllable, tendency, stance, velvet light, a horse vanishing into a canyon. Rest stop filth, faucets, tile. Mm. She escaped from the party and was found near these mountains. A car buried to its gone windows in thistle, in restless grass. The goldenrod brutally yellow. Note, your vocation is to be faithful. All night the threnody of trains, their keening and scream, the cry after something breaks, a heart pulled past bearing, his voice silicate, vertical, a flower that looks like a paintbrush upended, as if it had been touched to crimson, then poised at the trail's edge. You must act as if the truth were true.
Truly, the way to be faithful is to notice. Mm-hmm. And so. That is what we get from that poem.
I think so.
You are really an imagist, aren't you?
I think you learn about yourself as you read poems to people and as other people respond to them. And I suppose, yeah, the images, I do a lot of cataloging.
Oh.
And I suppose that is a result of what one notices as you walk.
What is cataloging? I mean, as a scholar?
No, I mean just catalog
as
poems,
a poet.
List poems, sort of collections of, you know, almost like snapshots or images. I keep a notebook and it's full of that sort of thing. That poem really grew out of one of those.
The images. Well, another remark about your work is that it references Ezra Pound. The natural object is always the adequate symbol. That was perfect for you.
I think that was Donald Hall who came up with that. He became a friend of mine after my husband Michael died of leukemia. And I wrote to Don because I knew he had gone through that with Jane. I knew Jane Kenyon's work. And I didn't really expect him to write back, but he did. And so we started this correspondence, and finally I was brave enough to send him some poems. And that was it was Don who told me I had quit caring very much about poetry during Michael's illness and afterwards. And Don was the one who said, you got to send them out whether you care about them or not.
And this book is dedicated to Michael.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
Now I understand. Mm-hmm. I do. How did Billy Collins know about your poem, Hoop Snake, in order to include it in his catalog?
I think what happened, he was asked, the Quad Cities where I live, the Quad City Arts Program, one of the people there was a huge fan of Billy Collins and managed to raise enough money to get him to come and give a reading there, and asked if I would have dinner with him. I don't know, because we were going to talk in verse or something. I'm not sure. And then I learned later she had sent him my book ahead of time just so he would know who he was having dinner with. And I think that's how he learned about my poetry.
Idiosyncratic, but isn't that the way everything works?
Yeah, yeah.
And a little bit of luck.
Yeah.
A little bit of luck.
Yeah.
We could say that people can check www.loc.gov/poetry. And that will put you in touch with something that's a text that says 180 poems. Mm-hmm. And if you click on that, you might find yours, right?
Yeah, it's in there. I think. I haven't checked it out.
Rebecca
Wee, that he collected.
W-E-E, and it's would be called Hoop Snake. Mm-hmm. So that'll be fun. Thinking the millions of people that use the library website, that is so good. Well, we're going to move back to another poem.
All right. This is the last poem in the book, titled What We Are. It's another catalog. I think this one is an attempt to render some span of collective human experience in concrete and sensory terms, like you were talking about, I suppose. So it's a kind of peculiar poem. What We Are. Detritus, windburn, a lazy eye, filament, flux, and implication. Overabundance of white, lamentation, duplicity laying claim, delirium and water, deer suffing past a woodpile, flicker of tongues, old eyes, ice, a long moan running down the shore, the ache and threat of want, the possibility of being ruined by a breath, a glance, a quick wind, a slamming door, the wrong eyes at the window. White birch, the moon's stain, what wasn't said but took root nonetheless. That look you have when you shake off sleep and come back to me, your mind working hard to unfold, quickly, quickly. Desire and stupor, history, this, tracks through snow, leading out.
I think that I get amazement that we endure in your work. There is always endurance and there's always amazement.
Yeah.
Even, and the ending of that definitely chronicles it. You have four poems that are devastating about loss and not personal loss. One mm-hmm. is called Missing.
Yeah.
One is called Accident. One is called Damage. I think one is about a tornado. And,
mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And each one of those marvels that we survive
yeah.
and that we even find beauty.
Yes. In fact, the book's title, Uncertain Grace, I took from a photography exhibit, and I'll read that poem later, by Sebastio Salgado. And, yeah, I saw that here in D.C. at the Corcoran Gallery in probably 1992. And his exhibit was titled An Uncertain Grace, and they were photographs of famine victims and, such devastation, and yet the photographs were so beautiful. And that tension, I suppose, is what interests me most, that, how in the world do we survive and bear what it is that we have to go through? And people do it.
Always. Your book is a testament to that. Mm-hmm. I wonder if your next book is in that same light. You have a forthcoming manuscript, and
yes.
is that called Instead?
Yes, it is. It's interesting how that has taken shape. I think it will be in two sections. And the first section of Instead is going to have the poems that were the grief poems in the aftermath of Michael's death. And really my Instead at that point had to do with I wanted to be anything other than alive. I would rather have been a puddle on the ground. I would rather have been a word. I would rather have been anything but human. Then the second part of the book, as I'm understanding it right now, will be another section of Instead, which is a return to living and to wanting to live. And I think it's connected with, enough time passing, enough grace coming, when you least expect it. Probably being pregnant when I thought I had missed my chance for that. And so the insteads in the book are two different kinds.
It is going to be a significant book.
Well,
do you write a book at a time? I mean, do you accumulate poems with the full knowledge that these are part of a whole?
No, that's what makes putting the book together sort of strange, because at least in this book, they were written over quite a span of time, and I didn't have a sense of themes or of, I think...
They all come from the same person.
They
and
do.
They're all connected, and they're also pretty much about the world. They're travel, almost travel poems. One thinks you're a great traveler, but it might be just from photographs at the Corcoran,
and it might be
mosaics, and it might be...
Yeah. I did travel a fair bit as a student. I went and lived in Thailand as a student and traveled in the Far East, but was very briefly in the places where I stayed. So I felt a little unsure about how you write about that. You know, it's not your home. It's not your place. You're observing. And so how accurate can you be? And probably that's part of what interested me in Carolyn Forché's work when I first encountered it in her book, The Country Between Us, because she was this American from Detroit who was writing about what she had seen in Salvador. But
this is why I say writers lead a very honorable life.
Yeah.
Because they're always evaluating the ethics of how do I really talk in my grandparents' voice? What right do I have to speak about the village you're carrying straw?
Right.
And that is kind of a moral life to lead.
Yeah, and it's complicated because it's easy to
step
abuse
on
it,
that.
I think.
Mm.
Yep.
Rebecca Wee at the Library of Congress. She's an assistant professor of English at Augustana College, and that's in Illinois. She was an instructor at, let me see how you say that, Gustavus Adolphus?
Oh, Gustavus Adolphus.
Gustavus Adolphus, and that was in Minnesota.
Yeah.
And then at St. Olaf College in Minnesota. You're from Minnesota?
Yes, and that's my Scandinavian background in all those small liberal arts colleges.
And was formerly an instructor at George Mason University, where she assisted Carolyn Forché in assembling the book. And that is called, let me see.
That was her anthology,
Against Forgetting. Against Forgetting. What did you do for that?
Oh, my. It was a lot of the busy work. She had been collecting poems for years, you know, maybe a decade, of these poems of witness, and had just gotten Norton to agree that they could be put into a book, but she didn't have much of a budget, and so I helped her along with other students. We were choosing which poems.
Helping to edit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. A lot of it was paperwork, but in the earlier stages, we did get to help her.
Against Forgetting, right. What year was that?
It came out in 93, I believe.
And then you were very, very busy helping to edit So to Speak, which was a woman's magazine, a journal.
Yeah,
that came
at
George Mason University.
Yeah.
And you're involved in women's studies.
Yes, at Augustana, we have a women's studies minor there. And so faculty from any department who's interested in working with students in the minor. Yeah, I was thinking...
Where are women's studies these days?
Yeah. Oh,
I'll tell you where they were.
What a question.
Well,
it depends on who you talk to, you know. This group of scholars at Augustana who started this program, I think, almost two decades earlier, and some of them are still there, are thrilled with how the program has grown and changed. And yet, I think everybody's aware of the things that don't change much and how frustrating that is. That
you teach women authors?
Yes.
The history as well?
Some of both. What I've ended up teaching through there are women poets, essentially. Women writers. I guess I did teach a British romantic poets where we were, whether this was a while ago, or we were trying to discover that there were women writing then. They just weren't published.
I'm writing a play on Mary Wollstonecraft,
the
18th century,
mm-hmm.
of course, and getting very much into this, where the women that were writing fluffy novels before her were writing in men's names.
Right, exactly.
So then I was teaching in Antioch 35 years ago, and the book I had, which had about 400 pages, had five women in it.
Yeah, I know.
That was in the 70s. And I just think it is so funny. Of course, then later we had a big preponderance of women's studies, mm-hmm. and I know very powerful programs at the University of Maryland with Martha Smith. Then all of a sudden, it seems to have tapered out again.
There's almost a backlash, I think, connected with the political correctness. The students who come in now are really impatient with, you know, our efforts to get them to think about inclusive language. Or it's kind of like I've heard that don't feed me that, where when I was in college, it was new.
Oh, and so that's interesting.
There seems to be a sort of weariness and also a desire, I think, on the students' part to say, we've solved that. We don't have problems anymore with racism, with sexism. So,
but there are fewer women published.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, it's still, I think in some ways it's a sneakier problem because we have made the progress we've made. And this in terms of race, in terms of gender, in terms of gay rights, too, I think, because we have made the sort of progress and laws have changed and things have happened, but it means that the problems that are still there in some ways are more hidden than they were before. And
Every college doesn't even have a women's studies before. They used to.
Yeah.
It used to be very, very prominent. This is Rebecca Wee. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and we're at the Library of Congress on The Poet and the Poem, and we're moving back into poetry, and it looks like it's a brand new one.
It is. It's not in the book. This will be one. I've written just a few poems about Michael's ordeal and his death. I don't know if there are more to come. It took such a long time to recover that it was really hard to go back into those places to write the poems.
But in Uncertain Grace, you have one hospital poem.
Yes, there's one. It's the one we were in Austria when he was diagnosed. We had just gotten over there. He was teaching in Salzburg. He was a philosophy teacher. And I was going to do a project with Czech women writers. And he'd had this cold all winter that turned out to be leukemia. So we weren't there long. We had to come back. But that poem in the book is one of those days waiting for test results, you know, in this other country where I didn't speak the language. And
fantastic poem. And the last line where you observe some patient walking
somebody else
in the hallway, walking to either her life or her death.
Yes. And I think now when I look at that, that was very much obviously what we were facing, but you don't want to, so you focus on somebody else. You know, somebody else is here in the blood ward getting either good or bad news.
But that's typical of your writing also.
Yeah.
That's what I mean about the distance, mm-hmm. which allows us to get in.
Yeah.
So we'll hear this new one.
All right. This is untitled, but it's been given the first line becomes the title. Donald Hall chose this one for Plowshares. I think it was the 30th anniversary edition. So it's been published there. How was it sudden, your long death? Shock fixed, black. Parking lots, ramps, the bright art in the hallways, flagrant flowers, a fish tank in the white places. One latex glove, like petals, spilled on the way to or from some room with a horror in it. Glass coffin, rice flour, your skin taking on radiation burn, your heart's new gallop, your eyes without you behind them. The toxic pills, soldiers in small paper cups. Each day the walk past hibiscus blossoms, each day's sunny traffic, peculiar trees with white thorns in the bark. Each day with white thorns. Your grip on the bed rail, the acid you vomit, the shiny cards you will not have pinned to the wall, the bloodstains. Then, exile of such physical scope, my tongue torn from its place, incisions in every lungful of air, every day more frantic for tokens, strands, an old letter. Words in your hand, some evidence that you were here. It was not fabrication, chimera, conceit. not like anything else, our language, your touch. Water in the Mojave, left off the maps. Wild mustard in the bluffs, in the cornfields, a soft wind. When you died, the sky opened. It does not close.
Wild mustard. I love the way you move out of that situation into the natural world.
Back where we were when things were healthy, you know, the places. We were married in the Mojave Desert. We spent a lot of time in California where Michael was finishing his dissertation. We had traveled together. We had been in some of the most beautiful places. And so the shift to this world of the hospital that was so...
But then moving out of it is so like you.
Yeah.
And this is very different from Uncertain Grace, where I feel that you use a lot of illusion to cover tragedy. And many veils that we love to lift through the poem, and also magic. I mean, there's a lot of magical elements in your writing, and then you bring in reality in the last line sometimes.
Right.
This, you are right there, still a majestic, and still fragmentary, so that we pull it together, but different in tone.
Yeah, it is. It's
a different book.
Yeah, it'll be probably part of that first section of Instead, you know, the grief that is so intense that it really silences you, I think.
Do you have hopes for publication? Has anyone seen it?
I haven't showed it to anybody yet. I suspect I'll ask Copper Canyon if they want to look at it because they've been so good to me. But no, I haven't gotten that far. It's still... I have the title. I know what I want on the cover, and I have about 10
the
poems,
cover.
But it, you know, there's a lot of work
you have
left
10.
To do. I think it's about 10 or 12.
About 50 more.
I know.
So
I know.
We'll
sabbatical.
Rush you home.
It's how I will spend sabbatical this year.
So Rebecca Wee is here. Ed, give us another poem.
All right. I will read. I brought a few. This is the poem
I've
been mentioning.
I love premieres, by the way. We love to hear things that no one else in the world has heard.
Good. Well, this is Instead, and this was the first of the Instead poems I wrote. And this came out of a community project that one of our libraries organized a couple years ago. It was called the Poem Art Odyssey. And the librarian whose concept this was she for a year. She got six poets, six painters from our area. She somehow contacted Robert Creeley and asked if he would write an initial poem, which he did, and that went in January to a painter who rendered his poem as painting. In February, that painting went to a poet, and it went back and forth all year until we had this sort of pilgrimage, and we had an exhibit and a reading, and Robert came for that. And I was somewhere in the middle. I was June or July, I think. And so this was the poem that came out of the painting that I had received. And all we got to see was, you know, the piece that we were responding to. It's kind of like a telephone game, I suppose, where you only see the one part. And
you had one painting to respond to.
Mm-hmm. And no idea where that had come from or what.
You don't know who painted it.
Yes, we did have the name, but we weren't supposed to talk to each other about what they were doing, you know. So I just got the image, and this is what
is that going to be the cover of the book?
Well, you know, you don't ultimately get to decide. No, I'm interested in a David Hockney photo collage that is sort of the direction I've been moving, called Pear Blossom Highway, that I want to put on the cover.
Is it hard to get permission?
Yes, and. You know, the publisher has to decide what will sell, and, you know, there's the practical aspects of it. So it's just my dream. We'll see if it happens. So this is Instead, and it opens with a couple lines from a poet whose work I admire named Larissa Sporluck. "But who would you be?" asks the universe. "Not this. Not this body. Instead. Something liquid or sea-tossed. Maybe rooted. Better a parasitic flowering plant, lupin or pearly everlasting. Low clouds, red rain, a ventifact loved through time by the wind's stamina. Maybe a word, samovar, egret. Something with jade's opulence and shine, a painting or pond, a soft night rabbits astir in the grass. But not this pressing, heavy flesh, not this want, nor the fictions, the fairy tales made for the kiss, the brooding prince, the instant conversion, not this ache for what's leaving or gone. Rather tulips in pots on an Amsterdam ledge, the dusted, watery, fog-blue spruce, a squall off the lake, the time poppies take to undress. Or a downpour, a working hinge, Sirocco wind through a dream. Parable, prayer, the bruised white moon, even a fish, a frog would suffice, even the doomed morning cloak it eyes. Let it be anything but the human heart's monstrous charge, thrusting its blood through the world.
Powerful last line.
Yeah, there's one of my depressed, you know, I'd rather be anything that, you know, rather than human. The morning cloak is a kind of butterfly. So it's morning as in M-O-U-R. And so, you know, I'd even rather be this butterfly that's about to be eaten by a frog than...
I like the poppy.
Yeah, and the poppy.
Undressing.
Well, this one, I suppose, does what you were describing. It goes back and forth. I don't want to be this, but I could be this. So there's the wish to kind of shed.
It's tentative.
Yeah.
It is. But it's just brilliant, and it's just luminous with the artifacts in the poem.
No, oh,
I mean, I just loved seeing them.
That's...
The image is all. The image is all.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's so easy to get thinky about it, you know.
Right.
In fact, did you begin that way?
As no, a writer? No, really. You mean with this poem?
No, as a writer, did you start... As an intellectual writer, saying this is how it is and telling your story, you're not a narrative poet.
No, I have a few narrative poems, but not so much.
You're a lyric poet.
Yeah, catalogs and fragments. No, I feel like it was all sort of an accident. I always wrote. I always kept journals. I, you know, as a kid, I loved the sound of poems and the imagination of fairy tales and all of that. But I feel like, you know, my decision to go off to graduate school had nothing to do with hoping to teach or even to be a poet. I just loved Carolyn Forché's work so much. I wanted to study with her. And that's all the further my thinking went. I didn't really expect anything that's happened. So.
She's pivotal in this time.
Yeah.
I think.
Oh, yeah. And definitely in my... I mean, I wouldn't have gone to graduate school. I never applied to any other program. I didn't know anything about George Mason. I just thought, I want to study with that woman, and if she thinks that school is a good one to teach, then I'll...
So did you study a lot with her?
Yeah, she became...
Your mentor?
A mentor and a really good friend. And she... I was lucky that way, too, because obviously she travels a lot.
And very busy.
A lot of students interested in working with her, and so...
Rebecca Wee. I'm Grace Cavalieri, and this is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress, and we're getting new poems.
Yes, I'll do one more that's new and not in the book. This one, I think, the title is Caesura, and I think of it as the first poem I wrote that was sort of a pause in the grieving that I did after Michael died. It was a poem that marked, I think, the first time, maybe 18 months after he died, that I recognized what I remembered as happiness. So this is Caesura. Before the moon took itself out of sight, before it passed unsnagged through the tree's fingers, before dusk light altered the unraked yard, a tiny bush has thrown forth late buds, roses the size of small stones breathing in the wrong season. Before that leaf, precisely the shape of a heart on a branch off the path, such yellow bleeding, such unexpected shine. Before the sounds of silverware, histories, hands reaching, the gestures withheld, before music in the room's tired walls, an open door, doors closing. Maybe they sat on the floor before want and shatter, one of them stammering, maybe poised, one of them with a ready heart, then wishing it back or misplacing it, before other moons over rooftops, trees before that, other seasons and their leaves flaring and falling this way.
Certainly the poet of essence. Certainly the poet of essence.
Thank you. Yeah, that poem continues to interest me. I haven't studied it in much detail.
Well, you're highly intuitive. I mean, this is clearly work that trusts that the reader knows as much about the world and about the heart as you do. You really believe that we know as much as you do. And I think that is a very fine approach to writing, where you believe in the invisible and you leave it on the page. You say, I believe in the invisible so much that I'm going to leave a lot of it here. And you can fill in the blanks. And it all comes together as pointillistic. It comes together and creates its shape that is perfectly clear and understandable.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. That's a lovely
way
to put it.
Just by trusting. You have a high level of trust or innocence.
or perhaps, it's the reason I can't do occasional poems, right? If I imagine an audience, then I can't do it, you know.
Public art, right. That would be very hard, but you've done that.
I've done it. I don't know that I've done it successfully, but I've given myself the challenge of it. And it's hard because I am very self-conscious then in the process of writing. I already, sort of know that people will be listening or it's an event where they want to hear a certain thing. And I don't. I'm not very good at it. But I like the challenge.
So. Well, that brings me to an interest in your process. And I wonder if I asked you to take a poem and dissect it for us, which would come to your mind?
Which poem?
Where you? I say to you now. Where were you? Were you sitting on the subway when you got the idea for that poem? From its inchoate beginning, where you imagined the poem,
sure,
and then how you set down the first line, and then where you got the, maybe you went to your shoebox full of dirty images and pulled out a pile,
right.
How you did it.
Right. I'll do one I wasn't planning to read that can answer that pretty well. And it's a poem in the book called Mount Pleasant Hydrangea.
Oh, yeah.
Which I wrote when I was living here in Washington as a graduate student. I lived in Mount Pleasant, and moved here from Minnesota, where I had lived in the country, and we never locked our houses or our cars or, you know, there were no, well, I grew up in a small town. So coming to D.C. was devastating and wonderful. I lived in Mount Pleasant, and at the time, I haven't been back to the neighborhood, so I don't know whether it's changed. It was a beautiful neighborhood with families and brownstones and front yards full of flowers. But it was very dangerous. It felt like we were always under house arrest. There were always sirens, search helicopters. I'd come home from school late at night, and the mist I'd see out my window would turn out to be tear gas. You know, so it was quite something. And this poem, although I think it took me a while to realize what I think it's about, I do remember writing it. And it's a poem, like the first one I read, The Philosopher, that I think the poems knew a lot more than I did at the time of writing them.
I like that.
So do you want to hear the hydrangea poem, or should I just talk about
how
I did it?
Well, you did tell me your location, so we have you located.
Yep.
And tell me about the day you decided to write the poem.
What I remember is I had not seen hydrangea before. In Minnesota, we don't have them. And the home that we were living on the top floor of someone else's house. And I had opened the front door, and, you know, his house had an alarm system, and I was always panicked about opening doors and not remembering the code and all of that. But I had opened the front door, and here was this enormous blue pom-pom of a flower that looked fake to me. I'd never seen anything like it. And I went back inside, and, you know, I probably had an assignment for class. I don't even remember that for sure, but this was part of
I bet it's blue, right?
Oh, yeah, bright
because
blue.
You're the blue queen of blue.
Bright blue.
We might have a blue in every other of your poems.
I think so. I read somewhere once that poets tend to favor blue, and that you find a lot of blue in poetry.
Well, the spiritual leaders tell us that that is the color of communication.
Oh, interesting.
That's the throat chakra.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. Yes, so hydrangea, this was...
And tell us how you entered your first line, because I think you enter each line very differently. Each poem enters very differently, which I admire.
It's often, as was the case with this, it's just a response to something I saw or something I read or something I felt. And I usually don't know where I'm going, at least the poems I stay interested in. I'm clueless. That's hard to trust because you can write a lot of bad poems that way too. But this one, I don't even remember why I left I out of it. The first line is just, opened the door to find no one, rather than I opened the door. Why I'm leaving the self out of it.
You never start with an I.
I think I have poems. I remember Jane Kenyon saying that she had made a New Year's resolution once to not put I in her poems, and then the first poem she wrote was just full of I. So it's true that once you set those rules, you usually can't keep to them. And I think there may be I's in the poem. Maybe there aren't. But the first line, opened the door to find no one who might have knocked, was this sort of disembodied sense of being out of an element that I was familiar with, kind of amazed and fascinated by, you know, new plants, new foliage, new neighborhood, but also quite fearful. You know, I'm not a naturally courageous person, I don't think, and so I was intrigued but afraid. And the poem later, when I looked back at it, struck me as one that was about a kind of claustrophobia that I guess I just didn't think very much about at the time. I knew I was nervous to walk to the subway or to, you know, arrive home late at night, and that I hadn't been in my previous life. But yeah, the first stanza is just, opened the door to find no one who might have knocked, but instead blue flowers hang heavy and obscene from stalks bent over the walk. And that really was just, you know, that's what
a
I
picture.
Saw. And that's where the poem started. Then it took off into this world of blue. So I have all these different kinds of blue, not aquamarine, not azure, not even sky blue, but blue like the rims of stained carnations, the sharp blue of plastic shovels and pails for the beach, like a notebook with a blue cover, the blue caps of pens. So there it moved into kind of artificial. I mean, the flowers looked fake to me. They seemed like they would be, you know, plastic. So I moved into all the kind of bright fake blue of pens and plastic shovels, and the way that when they stain the edges of carnations different colors, you know, it doesn't look real. Then it moved from that, from this flower, to falsely blue things, I suppose, to, and these are the petals, and these the blue stems that grow in my rooms. At dinner, suddenly they push up through the floor, though the guests don't see how their legs are being wrapped in leaves, how the great blue blooms have reached their napkin laps, the cool bowls of soup. So suddenly you moved indoors, and there are other people there, but this, you know, it's a fairly surreal image, I suppose.
Very.
These flowers coming up and sort
getting
of
into
overtaking.
The soup.
Yeah, over, to, you know, wrapping
getting
the people
up.
So we've gone inside, but so have the flowers, you know, so has this sort of presence. Then when we walk the streets, no one sees the flowers filling the children's mouths. So again, the speaker, I suppose, feels alone in seeing what's being seen and that nobody else is aware of it. And that what is being seen is threatening. You know, these, you know, even the kids playing on the street have mouths full of flowers, but they presumably don't know it, and nobody else is noticing. The men lounging on storefront steps don't feel the blue anthers moving up through their pockets. There are stamens in the eaves, porches and bird baths overrun, pollen spilling from tailpipes, indigo pavement, cerulean lawns, blue mist in the rooms where tea steeps. So everything, you know, whether it's exhaust from the car, the street, the landscape, everything has sort of turned blue or been overcome by blue. None of this was planned. You know, this was the poem sort of happening on its own.
That's why it's alive on the page.
Yeah, there's a sort
of... It's not a chess game.
Strange, an organic motion to it that, again, you know, when you finish writing a poem like this, you sort of look back and think, what is it? You know, what have I done?
Well, it's the poet as other, clearly.
I suppose.
The poet is the one that sees things
Yeah.
That
yeah.
aren't there, thank God.
And that sort of move inside of you in, you know, really marvelous and also terribly uncomfortable ways, I suppose. And I guess I better read the last two lines. I'm not fond of them. They've bothered me always, but I've never really figured out how else to end. Blue mist in the rooms where tea steeps, where veins like blue roots make their way through us to blossom, to vigorous rot. So there you have, you know, sort of the human experience. Yes, your own blood, blue in your veins, that causes you to grow but is also going to kill you, you know, or be the death of us.
It's all there.
Yeah, it is.
Uncertain Grace, Copper Canyon Press, Rebecca Wee is her name. We're at the Library of Congress. We're moving back into this book.
All right.
We're getting to hear a lot. I'm very happy that we're getting to hear a lot.
I'm glad. I'll read, since you mentioned magic earlier, this is probably the poem most blatantly magical. And it's a poem about a true experience, but it wasn't mine. My cousin, Beth Maxwell, we grew up as sisters, same age, went to college together. She was a math and science person, and I was a language art person. And we spent a lot of our childhood, and still to this day, with Beth trying to explain to me phenomena that I didn't want to know the details or the specifics. She'd say, you might as well know that, you know, that ring around the moon is caused by da-da-da-da, where I wanted to invent what it was about. And so we've had an interesting relationship that way. She and her husband were doing medical work in Kenya about 12 or 13 years ago and had this experience, which they wrote to their mother, and she told my grandmother and told my mother. And by the time the story got to me, I was so fascinated by how my logical, rational cousin and her husband were going to explain this event. So the title is Ajabu, and that's a Swahili word for magical. I don't think there's anything else in here. Migori is a larger town, about an hour from their village, and green mambas are kind of snake. Ajabu. Kenyan stamps on blue tissue, the usual pregnant arrival of words. Always a marvel with facts and specifics, she notices things no one else notices, then shares them with a practical generosity. You might as well know this. And after she says she's grown fat on chocolate, outlines a day of clinical work, and tells of a hippo, the green mambas in the yard, there is something else. A woman in labor, undilated and staring into the eyes of something, she arrived alone from the village. No supplies in the cabinets, no time, and 2 hours of one ruptured dirt road. They carried her to the jeep, knew they'd never make Migori before she collapsed. Then, how stunned we were to find the road repaired. The ruts filled in, tangled roots and rock removed, smoothed over. They made it in 45 minutes, delivered the woman and her child, and afterward asked when the road was restored, how, by whom, why had they heard no shovels, no singing? The nurses shook their heads then, the hagglers in the market shrugged. At dusk, they turned the jeep for home, lurched back onto the road, and you must know this. She writes of the endless ragged tracks, the old sprawling scar, and how for 2 hours, in silence, they labored their way back, each star beating down.
Love the last line. So she got there in 45 minutes, and it took 2 hours to get home.
It was one of those roads, you know, as I was often in developing countries, there will be one road from a village that you simply can't drive quickly on. And, yeah, when they needed it...
magically, it was there.
It was there, and then it wasn't. And apparently, when they did ask people about it, everyone said, Jabu, you know.
Oh!
So there was no surprise on the part of the people who lived there, just us. So I'll do one little snapshot poem. This one is titled Pont des Arts, which was a bridge in Paris, and this was a little observed moment that grew in my imagination afterwards. I think it's clear what I'm looking at. Pont des Arts. She's bent in a posture of anguish or prayer in a spot of city filth. Head down, a stained knit cap with its few coins on the ground beside her, and her pliant child, a shadow. Someone veers past with a friend in a clamor of rings and scarves. A pretty child skips after them, scattering pigeons. The mothers miss how their daughter's eyes catch then, the wary, open-mouthed stares. A terrible knowledge passes between them, the bridge rippling under their feet. As the polished child rushes past, but looks back at the one on the bridge in the heat, the sun-blown, silent one, whose hand has pulled back and flown up to smooth for a moment her heavy hair.
And may we have a final poem?
Yes. I will read the title poem, Uncertain Grace. And as I mentioned, this was inspired by the photography exhibit, Sebastio Salgado's exhibit titled An Uncertain Grace. Yeah, and I think I said this, what struck me most by those photographs, I wasn't familiar with his work, was that tension between really harrowing subject matter and the beauty of the art, and how that felt really necessary to me and really wrong at the same time. You know, how can you photograph this starving person, make a beautiful photograph of it that is up in a gallery wall where, you know, mostly the privileged are walking around, observing this image of a woman who's probably dead. And yet, the fact of the photograph speaks, you know, for her. So, Uncertain Grace, after Sebastio Salgado. How can she be beautiful? Eyes, ribs, the slope and angle of bone. The flesh itself is finished, so close it's come to the end of hunger. A husk set aside, tied at the knees and ankles. Thumbs hooked with clean white cord, what used to be. Famine in the sile, the eyes blown out. She graces and wrecks the gallery walls with her vanishing, her lips dark with flies. A man stubs out his cigarette. And still the earth's haunches, its flanks of sand, devious leaves and riverbeds, the pungent stars, something petaled and lush near the stone tomb where her eyes may yet open. Swept clean, someone has left a plate of salt fish and wine. This is arousal, how things live sometimes beyond great hurt. Elastic beauty, the lunatic flesh.
The voice of Rebecca Wee. This is The Poet and the Poem from the Library of Congress. We wish to thank the Motion Picture Broadcasting and Recorded Sound Division of the Library of Congress. This program is made possible by the Humanities Council of Washington, D.C. and the Witter Binner Foundation for Poetry. You can hear these programs on the library website, www.loc.gov/poetry, and find out more about The Poet and the Poem at www.gracecavalieri.com. Our engineer is Brittany Mule. Post-production is by Mike Turpin of MET Studios. I'm Grace Cavalieri.